Teach me your ways, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth, and I will praise you, O Lord, with all.
Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, an examination of Christian perspectives on theology, philosophy, ethics, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. And in the studio with us, we also have a friend of ours from down the street from the Pentagon, David Marley, who is an adjunct professor of American history at Montgomery College in Maryland. David, with your dissertation focusing on the development of the American religious right, I'm sure you have some very interesting perspectives on history, and I'm wondering, what's your opinion about America being founded as a Christian nation?
Well, my dissertation is entitled Pat Robertson and the Second Coming of the New Christian Right. It kind of looks at how the Christian right came in the late 70s with Jerry Falwell, the Mormon majority. That was kind of the first movement of it, and the second movement of it was Pat Robertson running for president in 88 and the Christian coalition forming after that. So that's kind of the bend I took on it.
We hear a lot of rhetoric from those movements. Now, I guess that kind of gives me away what I think. But we hear a lot of statements from these movements, the Christian Coalition, the Moral Majority, that America is a Christian nation, that it was founded on Christian principles. There are many books written saying we have this glorious Christian heritage. Now, you've delved a lot into that. Do you see that as valid? Do you see that those statements are true or reflective of what was going on at the foundation of this nation?
Well, there's a lot of things that people need to understand that I don't think many people do. I remember in high school on a retreat reading The Power and the Glory, which is a standard American history textbook that a lot of Christians read that talks about how Columbus was being led by God to found America and everything was that we did was biblically sound. And I remember actually applying for a teaching job early on at a junior high school. And I was being interviewed by the principal, and he had a copy of that on his shelf. And that was the book he used for his students to read. And I went, if that's the standard of what you want to use, I wasn't comfortable with it.
Why? What's the difficulty with that?
Well, even in high school, I realized what the difficulty was. And the older I get and the more into the research I got is they assume one real basic problem that you see a lot. And being in biblical studies, you see this all the time, is people assume that a word you use today had the same meaning 50 years ago, let alone 300-400 years ago. And the way people wrote and the way they talked is very different. Some people just read the text and they're very literal. This is literally what it means without understanding what that word meant to those people, assuming that the word has the exact same literal meaning. That's not always the case.
What was the case then? What are they talking about then?
When someone from the Christian right, one of their leaders, talks about America being a Christian nation, what they mean is the Puritans. And the Puritans came to Massachusetts to form a Christian nation. What they ignore is that when the Puritans came, there was already a huge colony in Jamestown and that they were spreading out into the countryside. And those people weren't there for religious reasons. It was presented as a colony that had strict religious rules where church attendance was mandatory and that kind of thing. But those rules and penalties, some severe penalties, as a matter of fact, weren't enforced. And the Puritans didn't come to America to form a country. They came to show England how to reform the Church of England. And their goal was, we want to reform the Church of England. We're going to be a city on the hill. That's a term that was used by Jesus and is used by Ronald Reagan, by the Puritans. It's used very often. America is a city on a hill. And they wanted to be an example to the British, and they wanted to go back one day and reform England. And, of course, that didn't happen. They stayed in America. They had children and grandchildren and developed into Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so that's what the average Christian right person thinks. First of all, they think of the Puritans, and second of all, they think of the writings of the Founding Fathers.
And what's in those writings? For those of us who aren't as well-versed in this stuff as you are, what do you find when you look in these writings? I mean, do you find a Christian nation?
I don't find a Christian nation. I don't think a lot of scholars do. And there's a couple reasons for that. A lot of historians aren't Christians themselves. Religion isn't a big part of their life. Faith isn't a big part of their life. so they don't see it. And I've had historians, published historians, tell me that, that they don't have any faith beliefs, so they don't incorporate that when they read people. And a problem with a lot of historians of the Christian right is they assume that they all have a very evil ulterior motive. And even though they say they're Christians and although they say they're doing these for religious reasons, they don't believe them, which I think is a huge error to make and really kind of arrogant. There's a man who runs a ministry in Dallas called Wall Builders, and I've seen some of their videos, and their purpose is to show that America was a Christian nation. And what he talks, and he uses a lot, one of the very first people he quotes is Thomas Jefferson. And the great thing about Thomas Jefferson is you can use him to prove almost any point you want to prove about American history. And he has quotes about Thomas Jefferson saying how he believed in the Bible and how the scripture was so important and how Jesus was this great man. And if you just look at those few quotes, that would lead you to believe that this was a Christian nation. But what he doesn't tell you about, what he never mentions in the one video that's over an hour long, he never mentions a thing called the Jefferson Bible. And then what he did is he took several copies of the New Testament and he cut out the portions that he didn't like. Didn't think Jesus could do miracles. Miracles were obviously made up. So those he cut out. Jesus couldn't have been the Son of God because that's ridiculous, because according to his Enlightenment theology, God just created the world and then walked away, kind of like winding a clock. So God wouldn't be active in our lives. So he cut out all the parts where Jesus referred to himself as God. So when he quotes the New Testament, he quotes the parts that he had saved. He was one of the leading men who established the freedom of religion, which I think is one of the greatest things about America as a nation. But privately, he thought Christianity was on the wane, and that if he had his choice, he wouldn't have had Christianity at all. I can't say he wanted to outlaw it, but he didn't think Christianity was going to survive and wouldn't last. But he thought people were so uneducated, they weren't ready to move beyond Christianity. So you look at him, you look at George Washington, who they talk about in Virginia, where I live, they say, and this is the church he attended, and he was a regular church attender, but he never took communion because he believed that Christ didn't die for our sins, that he was just a good moral leader, and that it ended there. So you see these people, Dreyer Falwell, Pat Robertson, all these men who believe these guys were very strong Christians, yet they wouldn't allow these kinds of men on their board of directors. These aren't men they would allow in their churches in any kind of leadership position, yet they look at them as leaders. And the big question you have to ask is why they do that.
So, I mean, this leaves us in a fairly awkward position because almost all of us grew up with an idea that there somehow was and is in our history, a Christian America. Yet, my question to you is, did this ever exist? What would it look like? And where does this idea come from that we were a Christian nation, that somehow those are our appropriate roots? A lot of the talk we hear within evangelical circles is we need to return America to its roots. Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea? And if so, what would those roots look like? Is this a Christian nation? If we did go back to America's roots, would we go back to a Christian nation, or would we go to a very diverse, separated, and really secularized nation? And how does this play out with the idea of we want to make America a Christian nation now? Is that a movement back, or is that a movement forward to something America has never been?
A lot of revisionist historians attempt to strip Christianity and religion away from everything, secularize everything, put it in kind of an economic model. But if you want to be really honest and look at it, you'll see that we're not too far away. America, from the very beginning, was a very pluralistic place, religiously speaking. Jews came to America very early, when the Dutch owned New York. When the slaves were brought over from Africa, they had their African religions. There were some Catholics, not too many, but there were the Puritans who were from a sect of the Church of England. The Church of England obviously was very huge. But from day one, America was very pluralistic. It was a nation of many, many different, not just Christian faiths, but many different faiths all around. And so when you think about Christian America, most people think about the Puritans. And what they did, the way they ran their entire society, was really noble. It was a real noble attempt that we're going to show not just fallen England, but fallen Europe, what true Christianity is. Brotherhood and sharing and community and moral living. And people think of it as being very strict and being very rigid. If you've seen the movie Shakespeare in Love, there's the scene where there's the Puritan yelling and he kind of quotes, "But a rose by any other name, smell is sweet," and that's where he gets it. But you see him as this very strict, very unhappy, plain-dressing moralist. But their whole emphasis was they wanted to live a life for the glory of God. And one thing that this is a complete aside, but one thing most people don't realize is they were very much for the idea of sex as a fun activity, not just for procreation, because it was a very Catholic idea that it was just for procreation. And the Puritans said, no, you can do this for fun, which when you think of, if you accuse someone of being puritanical, you think them of being very abstinence-oriented.
Interestingly enough, Hasidic Jews, same way.
Same way, interesting.
Very much oriented on the joys of living, and particularly of sexuality, a very strong expression in Hasidism.
Very interesting. And the Puritans had a strong sense of family. And even the way they set up their town and the way they set up their villages and the way they set up the lands of the tracts of land that people would farm were designed to share. So one farmer wouldn't have a huge tract of land. It would be split up. So in case one area didn't get rain, one man didn't suffer. Everyone kind of got less that area. And that's where you get the idea of a common, like Boston Common. It's where you put all the cattle and everything kind of grazed in the middle of town. And it was an area where everybody could kind of live together and kind of form a Christian community, and everybody went to one church. So everything in Puritan society was designed around a Christian ideal and following a certain morality.
So are you telling me, Dave, that, and you had no idea this was coming, but are you telling me that in some ways the early Puritans were communists?
To a certain extent, sure. But I believe that even in the very beginning, there's always been a strong social element to Christianity. Very strong. And it was in America where it became much more individualistic. Where if you look in Catholic nations today, there's still a sense of sharing and a sense of community that you don't see in American Protestantism, where it focuses on the individual. I know a rabbi who only counts the families that come to his church. He knows, oh, this family comes, this family comes. A lot of Catholic churches do the same, where the church I attend every Sunday, there's a list of how many people, you know, 912, 919, or there's an exact number counting how many individuals. And that's just one example of how American Christianity's role is very different than how it used to be.
So really, two things come to mind then. One, what kind of a role did the Puritans have? How significant is, because there is a body of literature there left from them, and obviously the Massachusetts Bay Colony was a very influential cultural, and still is a very influential cultural and political center, as well as the large universities on the East Coast, the Ivy League schools being founded in many ways as religious training institutions. How pervasive and influential was Puritan thought and Puritan social influence? Because it seems that from what you're saying, there is a culture war that was at play during the time of the formation of our nation. So in this cultural war, or at least this cultural tension, what role did the Puritans play? Were they sufficient enough to sway the nation to be what we could consider a Christian nation? Was this really a nation founded on God with a few pluralistic hangers-on, or was this a pluralistic nation in which there was one voice of radical, in that sense, radical separatist Protestantism?
Okay, a very good question. The Puritans have a much deeper impact on American history than I think anybody realizes. And that was the one big surprise that hit me when I was in grad school, when I was starting out. Focusing on the Christian right as I had earlier, I was really focused on modern American religious history. And I kind of considered the Puritans as just kind of, you know, early burp of American history. But they really were quite influential. The most influential theologians and some of the most famous theologians that America has ever produced were Puritans, or they were immediate descendants of the Puritans. Thinking of men like Jonathan Edwards, who was one of the leaders of the First Great Awakening, was definitely very heavily influenced by the Puritans. You think of Cotton Mather, who still holds the record for the most books published in America. He had over 600 books. We don't have the titles for most of them, but he published 600 books in his lifetime about theology in America and different theological principles. So in that case, they were very influential in the way they set up their whole life and their whole community. And one thing they really brought to us that the Jamestown colonies really didn't bring was a kind of sense of exceptionalism. The idea that I talked about before, which is that exceptionalism is a real good graduate student term. Use that whenever I'm in trouble. It was the idea that America was somehow set apart, that they were a city on a hill. That was the focus of the Plymouth colony and the early colonies in Massachusetts, the early cities, that they were different. They were a city on a hill. And so it attracted a lot of people who weren't Christians, who didn't want, or who were nominal Christians, who didn't want to live that rigid lifestyle, yet they wanted to live in that community. It's kind of like, I don't have a good example, like if somebody was working at Disneyland and they wanted to be in Disneyland and have the fun of Disneyland, but they didn't want to wear a uniform or follow the dress code or act a certain way. They wanted the experience, but they wanted to do it their own way. And that's when everything started to disintegrate. And as you know, if someone has a religious revival for themselves, a conversion experience, it's very difficult to pass that on to your children. And that's what the Puritans discovered very quickly, is that within two generations, the whole system was crumbling because the children didn't want to follow the rules anymore because it had been so diluted. But still, the theology that they believed in lives on in our theology today. A lot of what they brought to America still survives to a much greater extent than I think than a lot of people realize.
So if you were going to put it like percentage points, would you say they were a moral majority then in the nation? Or would you say they were a moral minority? And were they very politically? Because we could divide our nation into its political development, its social development, its economic development, its religious development. And yes, obviously the Puritans would have a huge impact on the religious development of the nation. Would you say that that carried over enough to be institutionalized in our governmental forms, in our economic forms, in our overall social makeup? What role would they have there? Or were the Virginia colonies more powerful in that? How was the balance between the North and the South? And if you want to say the conservative, although the Puritans would be, I guess, considered pretty much like a radical cult from the Church of England compared to them. And yet for America, they would be a conservative cult. So both ultimate liberal and ultimate conservative simultaneously, depending on which nation you're viewing them from.
Yeah, yeah, it very depends. Percentage points, that's a good question. I wouldn't know where to put them. I'd put them maybe in the teens or the 20s, but still higher, most, not huge, but not most people think about. But one thing to remember is each colony was so distinctly different. Think about Connecticut and Rhode Island were formed by people that were either kicked out or left Massachusetts because they didn't believe in what was going on. Roger Williams was kicked out several times of Massachusetts, so that's why he founded Rhode Island. You think about Pennsylvania was a Quaker state. That's where you get the name of the oil, Quaker State Oil. He was a Quaker and got this land from the King of England, and that was a place where a lot of pacifists were. Maryland had a lot of Catholics that went there, a huge number of Catholics. And New York City had a lot of Jews and Catholics staying there first because it was originally owned by the Dutch. It was originally named New Amsterdam. And in the South, pretty much everything south of the Potomac was the realm of the Church of England, which we now call the Anglican Church. So they were very much in control in the South, and they had a completely different economy, a completely different ideology on how things were run, much more, although everything was very authoritarian, at least in the Puritan, early Puritan societies, people still tended, they still had a voice. There were still town meetings where you could come together, and you followed the will of the elders, but there was still a sense of everybody can share, everybody can have an opinion, everybody can voice it. Where in the South, that certainly wasn't always the case. From day one, much stricter control over people's lives.
So in modern terms, we tend to think in terms of the conservatives and the liberals. How would those ideas reflect upon early American formation? Are these, like we've noticed with the Puritans, from the perspective of America, we think of them as the ultra-conservative core of an aspect of our national development. And yet, from the Church of England's perspective, they are a radical offshoot, what we would today consider like a cult. We're going to go out into the middle of nowhere to a completely undeveloped, unknown land, build a small colony, say that this is the way that you really do things, and have a very much a dominant internal structure with members only kind of an idea. Radical enough for them to leave their homes, radical enough to where they can't live in Church of England, Christian nation, and they can't live in the very strongly Protestant Dutch lands, and they don't want to enculturate anywhere else, and they come to a land that's, like to us, the wilderness, and set up a compound. So radicals from that view, but conservatives from us. So how would you cast these things in the jargon of the 20th century? Who were the liberals? Who were the conservatives? And what amount of power did they have in which ways?
Okay. Using modern terminology, you would say that the English were looking at the Puritans, who always considered themselves English. They never considered themselves to be American.
So they weren't really out to form a new nation under God, or?
No, they weren't. They wanted to be an example to England and then move back to England. That's why up until the time of the Revolutionary War, you could ask any American what was their biggest city, and they would say London. And like an American living in Charleston or in Boston had maybe been to London, but very rarely had ever been to New York City or any other large city in America. That was still the focus, all the cultural, the thinking, everything came out of there. So the American ideology didn't come about until the First Great Awakening. That was the first great social movement that got everybody in the colonies to think of themselves as Americans, as a distinct group from the English, which was interesting because it was led by a man from England, wasn't born in America. But to put everything in modern terminology, you would say, I have to say that the English viewed the Puritans as fundamentalists. They were very strict on how they viewed their theology, very strict, and they were persecuted for it in England. And under Elizabeth and under some later leaders, they were persecuted for their beliefs. And so they left. And to a certain extent, although they were so conservative religiously, politically, they tended to be more liberal. And that's why you see the first great abolitionist anti-slavery movements come out of Massachusetts and out of Boston. And when slavery was starting in America, that was the first place to outlaw it and first place to not let slavery take root. And there's other economic reasons for it. The ground wasn't set up. There weren't big plantations that couldn't afford that kind of economy. But an overriding reason was religious, that they viewed slavery as morally wrong. And whereas the Church of England wasn't as strong in the southern colonies, and so they had these large plantations and they needed workers. And so they were able to take slaves and create a theology to fit their needs, as opposed to the North that had a theology they weren't willing to alter their theology to fit reality. They kind of stuck to the truth. So in that case, they really were kind of fundamentalists who kind of held in the trenches and this is what we believe and we're not going to change. And even when they became very liberal, they still held on to a lot of those religiously liberal. They hold on to a lot of those beliefs. Yeah, so it was interesting spin. And if you look at all the abolitionists before the Civil War, kind of jumping ahead 2 centuries, every single major abolitionist was a member of what we would consider an Orthodox church, a very conservative theological church. You don't find Unitarians. You don't find some of these atheists speaking out for freeing the slaves. It was people from very conservative denominations, which I find very interesting because you wouldn't think of that today. When you think of somebody religiously conservative, you think of them as being politically conservative as well, where that hasn't always been the case.
What you bring up, Dave, is a very interesting observation and one that normally does not cross our minds, that in some ways a Christian may be theologically very conservative and yet politically and economically very liberal. And these are concepts which hit the American ear in the modern era, in the 20th century, or the end thereof, in a very strange way. And what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is have you back on the next show and maybe talk about the development of the Christian right as far as a political movement, and maybe how these things have crossed over from the Puritan dichotomy or the Puritan template of liberal and open social and economic political stances and conservative theology, and how those may have been transposed. I don't know if would you be into that?
I would love to.
Great. Fantastic. It's been great having you on the show. Appreciate you coming here and spending your time and sharing your wealth of knowledge with us, and we hope to mine you for a little bit more, if you don't mind.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, there it is. More perspective tweaking moments from Interface. We'd like to thank David Marley for joining us in the studio today, and thanks to Adam Ayers, as always, for being here. We'd like to thank our engineer, Chris Holowaty, for making the show sound so good. Thanks to Media City Sound for helping to make Interface possible, and thanks to you for listening.